I remembered hers. The poor dogs would not let you stroke their ears because they had been yanked by trainers, one of the many cruelties they suffered at dog tracks. Rose's eyes got bright with tears, and she turned her face from me and rubbed her knees. "This cold is hard on my joints," she commented, clearing her throat. "They were getting so old. It's just as well Laurel has them now. I couldn't bear another thing dying on me. I wish you would get one. If every nice person would just get one." The dogs were put to death by the hundreds every year when they could no longer perform up to speed. I shifted on the couch. There was so much in life that angered me. "Can I get you hot ginseng tea that dear Simon gets for me?" She mentioned the hairstylist she adored. "Maybe something a little stronger. I've been meaning to stop and pick up shortbread cookies." "I can't stay long," I said. "But I just wanted to drop by and make certain you're all right." "Why, of course," she replied, as if there were no reason in the world she wouldn't be. I paused, and Rose looked at me, waiting for me to explain why I really had dropped by. "I talked to Ruth," I began. "We're following a couple of leads and have our suspicions, which I'm sure lead right to Chuck," she announced, nodding her head. "I've always thought he's a bad apple, and he avoids me like the plague because he knows I see right through him. It will be a cold day in hell before the likes of him will charm me." "No one could charm you," I said. Handel's Messiah began, and intense sadness tucked itself into my heart. Her eyes searched my face. She knew how hard last Christmas had been for me. I had spent it in Miami, where I could avoid it as much as I could. But it wasn't possible for me to get away from music and lights, not even if I fled to Cuba. "What are you going to do this year?" she asked. "Maybe go out west," I replied. "If it would snow here, that would be easier, but I can't stand gray skies. Rain and ice storms, Richmond weather. You know, when I first moved here, we always got at least one or two good snows every winter." I envisioned snow piled on tree branches and blowing against my windshield, the world whited out as I drove to work, even though all state offices were closed. Snow and tropical sunshine were antidepressants for me. "It was very nice of you to check on me," my secretary said, getting up from the deep blue wing chair. "You've always worried too much about me, though." She went into the kitchen, and I heard her digging around in the freezer. When she returned to the living room, she handed me a Tupperware container with something frozen inside it. "My vegetable soup," she said. "Just what you need tonight." "You can't know how much," I told her, with heartfelt appreciation. "I'll go home and warm it up now." "Now what will you do about Chuck?" she asked, with a very serious expression on her face. I hesitated. I didn't want to ask her this. "Rose, he says you're my office snitch." "Well, I am." "I need you to be," I went on. "I'd like you to do whatever it takes to find out what he's up to." "What the little son of a bitch is up to is sabotage," said Rose, who almost never swore. "We've got to get the evidence," I said. "You know how the state is. It's harder to fire somebody than walk on water, but he's not going to win." She didn't respond right away. Then she said, "To start with, we mustn't underestimate him. He's not as smart as he thinks he is, but he's clever, and he has too much time to think and move about unnoticed. What's unfortunate is he knows your patterns better than anyone, better even than me, because I don't help you in the morgue, for which I'm grateful, and that's your center stage. That's where he could really ruin you." She was right, although I couldn't bear to admit the power he had. He could swap labels or toe tags or contaminate something. He could leak lies to reporters who would forever protect his identity. I could scarcely imagine the breadth of what he could do. "By the way," I said, getting up from the couch, "I'm fairly sure he has a computer at home, so he lied about that." She walked me to the door, and I remembered the car parked near mine. "Do you know anybody in the building who drives a dark Taurus?" I asked. She frowned, perplexed. "Well, they're rather much all over the place. But no, I can't think of anyone around me who drives one." Possibly there's a police officer who lives in your building and might drive such a car home now and then. I know nothing about it if there is. Don't get too carried away by all those little goblins that will rise up in your head if you let them. I have a firm belief about not giving a life to things, you know. The old bit about a self-fulfilled prophecy. Well, it's probably nothing, but I just had an odd feeling when I saw this person sitting inside a dark car, engine off, lights off, I said. I got the tag number. Good for you, Rose patted my back. Why am I not surprised? 16. My shoes seemed loud on the stairs as I left Rose's apartment, and I was conscious of my handgun when I went out the door into the cold night. The car was gone. I looked around for it as I approached mine. The parking lot was not well lit. Bare trees made slight sounds that turned ominous in my mind, and shadows seemed to hide fearful things. I quickly locked my doors, looking around some more, and called Marino's pager as I drove off. He called back right away because, of course, he was in uniform on the street without a damn thing to do. "Can you run a tag?" I said right off when he answered. "Lay it on me," I recited it to him. "I'm just leaving Rose's apartment," I said, "and I have a weird feeling about this car parked out there." Marino almost always took my weird feelings seriously. I was not one to have them often without justification. I was a lawyer and a physician. If anything, I was more inclined to stay inside my clinical, fact-only lawyer's mind and was not given to overreactions and emotional projections. "There are other things," I went on. "You want me to drop by?" "I sure would." He was waiting in my driveway when I got there, and he awkwardly climbed out of his car because his duty belt got in his way and the shoulder harness he never wore tended to snag him somewhere. "God damn it!" he said, yanking his belt free. "I don't know how much more I can stand this." He kicked the door shut. "Piece of shit car!"
"How'd you get here first, if it's such a piece of shit car?" I asked.
"I was closer than you. My back's killing me."
He continued to complain as we went up the steps and I unlocked the front door. I was startled by silence. The alarm light was green.
"Now that ain't good," Marino said.
"I know I said it this morning," I said.
"The housekeeper come?" he asked,
looking, listening. "She always sets it," I said. "I've never known her to forget, not once in the 2 years she's worked for me."
"You stay here," he said.
"I most certainly will not," I replied, because the last thing I wanted was to wait here alone, and it was never a good idea for two armed people to be nervous and on guard in different areas of the same space. I reset the alarm and followed him from room to room, watching him open every closet and look behind every shower curtain, drapery, and door. We searched both floors, and nothing was the least bit amiss until we went back downstairs, where I noticed the runner in the hallway. Half of it was vacuumed, while the other wasn't, and in the guest bath right off it, Marie, my housekeeper, had neglected to replace soiled hand towels with fresh ones. "She's not absent-minded like that," I said. "She and her husband are supporting young children on very little, and she works harder than anyone I know."
"I hope nobody calls me out," Marino complained. "You got any coffee in this joint?"
I made a strong pot with the Pilon espresso that Lucy sent me from Miami, and the bright red and yellow bag made me feel hurt again. Marino and I carried our cups into my office. I logged onto AOL using Ruffin's address and password, and was extremely relieved when I didn't get bumped off. "Coast is clear," I announced. Marino pulled up a chair and looked over my shoulder. Ruffin had mail. There were 8 messages, and I didn't recognize who any of them were from.
"What happens if you open them?" Marino wanted to know.
"They'll still be in the box as long as you save them as new," I replied.
"I mean, can he tell you opened them?"
"No, but the sender can. The sender can check the status of the mail he sent and see what time it was opened."
"Huh," Marino said with a shrug in his voice. "So what? How many people are going to check what friggin' time their mail was opened?"
I didn't answer him as I began to go into Chuck's mail. Maybe I should have felt frightened by what I was doing, but I was too angry. 4 of the emails were from his wife, who had many instructions for him about domestic matters that made Marino laugh.
"She's got his balls in a box on top of the fireplace," he gleefully said.
The address of the 5th message was M-A-Y-F-L-R, who simply said, "Need to talk." "That's interesting," I commented to Marino. "Let's check out mail he might have sent to whoever this Mayflower is." I went into the mail sent menu and discovered Chuck had been sending email to this person almost daily for the past 2 weeks. I quickly scanned through the notes, Marino looking on, and it became obvious in no time that my morgue supervisor was having rendezvous with this person, possibly an affair.
"I wonder who the hell she is," Marino said. "That'd be a nice little bit of leverage to hold over the son of a bitch."
"Not going to be easy to find out," I said. I quickly signed off, feeling as if I were escaping from a house I'd just burglarized.
"Let's try Chat Planet," I said.
The only reason I was familiar with chat rooms was that on occasion colleagues of mine from around the world used them to meet and ask for help in particularly difficult cases or share information that we might find useful. I signed on and downloaded the program and selected a box that made it possible for me to be in the chat room without anybody seeing me. I scanned the list of chat rooms and clicked on one called Dear Chief K. Dr. K herself was in the midst of moderating a chat session with 63 people.
"Oh, shit. Give me a cigarette, Marino," I tensely said.
He shook one out of the pack and pulled up a chair, sitting next to me while we eavesdropped. "Pipe Man, Dear Chief K, is it true Elvis died on the toilet and that many people die on the toilet? I'm a plumber, so you can see why I'm wondering. Thanks. Interested in Illinois. Dear Chief K.
Dear interested in Illinois, yes, I'm sorry to say that Elvis did die on the toilet, and that this isn't uncommon because people strain and strain and their heart can't take it. Elvis's many years of bad eating and pills, I'm sorry to say, finally caught up with him, and he died of cardiac arrest in his luxurious bathroom in Graceland. And this should be a lesson to all of us.
Medstu.
Dear Chief K, why did you decide you'd rather work with dead patients instead of living ones? Morbid in Montana.
Dear Chief K.
Dear Morbid in Montana, I don't have much of a bedside manner and don't have to worry how my patient is feeling. I found out during my medical school days that living patients are a pain in the ass.
Holy motherfucking shit, Marino said.
I was incensed, and there was nothing I could do about it.
You know, Marino said with indignation, I wish people would leave Elvis alone. I'm tired of hearing about him dying on the toilet.
Be quiet, Marino, I said. Please, I'm trying to think.
The session went on and on, all of it awful. I was tempted to butt into the conversations to tell everyone Dear Chief K wasn't me.
Any way to find out who Dear Chief K really is? Marino asked.
If this person is the moderator of the chat room, the answer's no. He or she can know who everybody else is, but not the other way around.
Julie W. Dear Chief K, since you know everything there is about anatomy, does that make you more aware of pleasure points, if you know what I mean? My boyfriend seems bored in bed, and sometimes he even falls asleep in the middle of it. Wanna be sexy?
Dear Chief K.
Dear Wanna be sexy, is he on any kind of medications that might make him sleepy? If not, sexy lingerie's not a bad idea. Women don't do enough anymore to make their men feel important and in charge.
That's it, I announced. I'm going to kill him, or her, whoever the hell this Chief K is.
I jumped out of my chair, so frustrated I didn't know what to do.
You don't fuck with my credibility.
Fists clenched, I practically race-walked to the great room, where I suddenly stopped and looked around as if I were in some place that I'd never been before.
Two can play this game, I said as I returned to my study. But how can two play when you don't even know who Chief K number two is? Marino asked.
Maybe I can't do anything about that goddamn chat room, but there's always email.
What kind of email? Marino warily asked.
Two can play this game. Just wait and see. Now, how about we check on our suspicious car? Marino slipped his portable radio off his belt and switched to the service channel.
"What did you say it was again?" he asked.
RGG-7112, I recited from memory.
"Virginia tags?"
"Sorry," I replied. "I didn't get that good of a look.
Well, we'll start there."
He relayed the tag number to the Virginia Criminal Information Network, or VCIN, and asked for a 1029. By now it was after 10 o'clock.
"Any way you could make me a sandwich or something before I leave?" Marino asked. "I'm about to die of hunger. Vison's been a little slow tonight. I hate that."
He requested bacon, lettuce, and tomato with Russian dressing and thick slices of onion, and I cooked the bacon well in the microwave instead of frying it.
"Ah, gee, Doc, why'd you have to do that?"
he said, holding up a crispy, non-greasy strip of bacon.
"It ain't good unless it's chewy and got some flavor left that wasn't soaked up in all those paper towels."
"It will have plenty of flavor," I said, "and the rest is up to you. I'm not going to be blamed for clogging up your arteries any worse than they probably already are." Marino toasted rye bread and slathered it with butter and Russian dressing he conjured up from Miracle Whip, ketchup, and chopped butter pickles. He topped this with lettuce, tomato liberally dashed with salt, and thick slices of raw sweet onion. He made two of these healthy creations and wrapped them in aluminum foil as the radio got back to him. The car was not a Ford Taurus, but a 1998 Ford Contour. It was dark blue and registered to Avis Leasing Corporation.
"That's kind of interesting," Marino said. "Usually in Richmond, all rental cars begin with an R, and you have to request a plate that doesn't. They started doing that so it wasn't so obvious to carjackers that someone was from out of town."
There were no outstanding warrants, and the car wasn't listed as stolen. 17. At 8 o'clock the next morning, Wednesday, I squeezed into a metered space. Across the street, the 18th-century capital of the Commonwealth was pristine behind wrought iron and fountains in the fog. Dr. Sinclair, other cabinet members, and the Attorney General worked in the 9th Street Executive Office Building, and security had gotten so extreme that I'd begun to feel like a criminal when I came here. Just inside the door was a table where a Capitol Police officer checked my satchel. "If you find anything in there," I said, "let me know, because I can't." The smiling officer looked very familiar, a short, fleshy man I guessed to be in his mid-30s. He had thinning brown hair and the face of one who had been boyishly cute before advancing years and added weight had begun to have their way with him. I held out my credentials, and he barely gave them a glance.
"Don't need those," he cheerfully said. "You remember me? I had to respond to your building a couple times when you used to be over there."
He pointed in the direction of my old building on 14th Street, which was only 5 short blocks east.
"Rick Hodges," he said. "That time they had the uranium scare. Remember that?"
"How could I not?" I said. "Not one of our finer moments."
"And me and Wingo used to hang out sometimes. During lunch, I'd come down when nothing much was going on."
A shadow crossed his face. Wingo was the best, most sensitive morgue supervisor I'd ever had. Several years ago, he died of smallpox.
I squeezed Hodges' shoulder.
"I still miss him," I said. "You have no idea how much." He looked around and leaned closer to me.
"You keep up with his family, any?" he asked in a low voice.
"From time to time." He knew from the way I said it that his family didn't want to talk about their gay son, nor did they want me calling. Certainly they didn't want Hodges or any of Wingo's friends calling either. Hodges nodded, pain dimming his eyes. He tried to smile it away.
"That boy sure was crazy about you, Doc," he said to me. "I've been wanting to tell you that for a long time."
"That means a lot," I said to him with feeling. "Thank you, Rick." I passed through the scanner without incident, and he handed me my satchel.
"Don't stay away so long," he said.
"I won't," I said, meeting his young blue eyes. "It makes me feel safer having you around."
"You know where you're going?"
"Think so," I said.
"Well, just remember, the elevator has a mind of its own."
I took worn granite steps to the 6th floor, where Sinclair Wagner's office overlooked Capitol Square. On this dark, rainy morning, I could barely see the statue of George Washington astride his horse. The temperature had plummeted 20 degrees during the night, and rain was small and hard like shotgun pellets. The waiting area of the Secretary of Health and Human Services was handsomely arranged with graceful colonial furniture and flags that were not Dr. Sinclair's style. His office was cramped and cluttered. It bespoke a man who worked extremely hard and understated his power. Dr. Wagner was born and raised in Charleston, South Carolina, where his first name, Sinclair, was pronounced Sinkler. He was a psychiatrist with a law degree and oversaw person service agencies such as mental health, substance abuse, social services, and Medicare. He had been on the faculty of the Medical College of Virginia, or MCV, before his appointment to a cabinet-level position, and I'd always respected him enormously, and knew he respected me, too.
"Kay," he rolled back his chair and got up from his desk. "How are you?"
He motioned for me to sit on the couch, and he closed the door and returned to the barrier of his desk, which was not a good sign.
"I'm pleased with how everything's going at the Institute, aren't you?" he asked.
"Very much so," I replied. "Daunting, but better than I ever hoped." He picked up his pipe and pouch of tobacco from an ashtray.
"I've been wondering what's been going on with you," he said. "You seem to have vanished off the face of the earth."
"I don't know why you'd say that," I answered him. "I'm doing as many cases as always, if not more."
"Oh, yes. Of course I keep up with you through the news."
He began tamping tobacco into the pipe. There was no smoking of any sort in the building, and Wagner tended to suck on a cold pipe when he was ill at ease. He knew I hadn't come here to talk about the Institute or tell him how busy I'd been.
"I certainly know how busy you are," he went on, "since you don't even have time to see me."
"I just found out today, Sinclair, that you tried to see me last week," I replied. He held my gaze, sucking on the pipe. Dr. Wagner was in his 60s, but looked older than that, as if bearing the painful secrets of patients for so many years had finally begun to erode him. He had kind eyes, and it was greatly to his advantage that people tended to forget he also had the shrewdness of a lawyer.
"If you didn't get my message that I wanted to see you, Kay," he said, "then it would seem to me you have a staffing problem."
His slow, low tone nudged words along, always taking the long way around a thought. "I do, but not of the sort you might imagine."
"I'm listening."
"Someone's been getting into my email," I flatly replied. "Apparently this person got into the file where our passwords are kept and got hold of mine."
"So much for security."
I held up my hand to stop him. "Sinclair, security's not the problem. I'm being hurt from within my own ranks. It's clear to me that someone, or perhaps more than one person, is trying to cause me trouble, perhaps even get me fired. Your secretary emailed mine to let her know you wanted to see me. My secretary passed this along to me, and I allegedly replied that I was too busy to see you at that time." I could tell Dr. Wagner found this confusing, if not ridiculous. "There are other things," I went on, getting increasingly uncomfortable with the sound of my own voice spinning what seemed such a fantastic web. "Emails asking calls to be rolled over to my deputy chief, and worst of all, this so-called chat room I'm doing on the Internet."
"I know about that," he grimly said. "And you're telling me that whoever is doing this dear Dr. K stuff is the same person using your password?"
"It's definitely someone using my password and posing as me." He was silent, sucking his pipe. "I'm very suspicious that my morgue supervisor is connected with all this," I added.
"Why?"
"Erratic behavior, hostility, disappearing acts. He's disgruntled and up to something. I could go on." Silence. "When I can prove his involvement," I said, "I'll take care of the problem." Dr. Wagner returned the pipe to the ashtray. He got up from his desk and came around to where I was sitting. He settled into a side chair. He leaned forward and looked intensely at me.
"I've known you for a long time, Kay," he said, in a kind but no-nonsense voice. "I'm well aware of your reputation, your tribute to the Commonwealth. You've also been through a horrendous tragedy, and it wasn't that long ago.
Are you trying to play the role of psychiatrist with me, Sinclair?
I wasn't joking. You aren't a machine. Nor am I given to wild thinking. What I'm telling you is real. Every brick of the case I'm building. There are just a lot of insidious activities going on, and while it may be true I've been more distracted than usual, what I'm telling you has nothing to do with that.
How can you be so sure, Kay, if you've been distracted, as you put it? Most people wouldn't even have returned to work for a while, if ever, after what you've suffered. When did you go back to work?
Sinclair, we all have our ways of coping.
Let me answer my own question for you, he went on. 10 days, and not a very happy environment to return to, I might add. Tragedy, death.
I didn't say anything as I fought for composure. I had been in a dark cave and scarcely remembered scattering Benton's ashes out to sea in Hilton Head, the place he loved most. I scarcely remembered clearing out his condo there, then attacking his drawers and closets at my house. At a maniacal speed, I removed everything right then that would have had to go eventually. Had it not been for Dr. Anna Zimmer, I couldn't have survived. She was an older woman, a psychiatrist who had been my friend for years. I had no idea what she did with Benton's fine suits and ties and polished leather shoes and colognes. I didn't want to know what happened to his BMW. Most of all, I couldn't bear to know what had been done with the linens that had been in our bathroom and on our bed. Anna had been wise enough to keep all belongings that mattered. She didn't touch his books or jewelry. She left his certificates and commendations hanging on the walls of his study, where nobody would see them because he was so modest. She wouldn't let me remove the photographs arranged everywhere because she said it was important for me to live with them.
"You must live with the memory," she told me repeatedly in her heavy German accent. "It is still present, Kay. You cannot run away from it. Don't try."
"On a scale of 10, how depressed are you, Kay?" Dr. Wagner's voice sounded somewhere in the background. I was still hurt and unable to accept that Lucy had never shown up once during all of this. Benton left me his condo in his will, and Lucy was furious with me for selling it, although she knew as well as I did that neither of us could ever pass through its rooms again. When I tried to give her his much-loved, scarred, scuffed bomber jacket he'd worn in college, she said she didn't want it, that she would give it to someone else. I knew she never did. I knew she hid it somewhere.
There's no shame in admitting it. I think it's hard for you to admit you're human.
Dr. Wagner's voice surfaced. My eyes cleared.
Have you thought of going on an antidepressant? Dr. Wagner asked me. Something mild like Wellbutrin?
I paused before I said anything. In the first place, Sinclair, I said, situational depression is normal. I don't need a pill to magically take away my grief. I may be stoical. I may find it difficult to show my emotions around others, to show my deepest feelings. And yes, it's easier for me to fight and get angry and overachieve than to feel pain. But I'm not wrapped tight in denial. I've got sense enough to know that grief has to run its course. And this isn't easy when those you trust begin to chip away at what little you have left in your life.
You just switched from first person to second person, he pointed out.
I'm just wondering if you're aware.
Don't dissect me, Sinclair. Kay, let me paint for you the portrait of tragedy, of violence, that those untouched by it never see, he said. It has a life of its own. It continues its rampage, although with more stealth and with less visible wounds as time moves on.
I see the portrait of tragedy every day, I said.
What about when you look in the mirror? He asked.
Sinclair, it's terrible enough to suffer loss, but to compound that with everyone looking askance at you and doubting your abilities to function anymore is to be kicked and degraded while you're supposedly down.
He held my gaze.
I had just switched to second person again, to that safer place, and I saw it in his eyes.
Cruelty thrives on what it perceives as weakness, I went on. I knew what evil was. I could smell it and recognize its features when it was in my midst.
Someone seized what happened to me as the long-awaited-for opportunity to destroy me, I concluded.
And you don't think this is perhaps a little paranoid? He finally spoke. No. Why would someone do that, besides being petty and jealous? He inquired.
Power, to steal my fire.
An interesting analogy, he said. Tell me what you mean by that.
I use my power for good, I explained. And whoever is trying to hurt me wants to appropriate my power for his own selfish use, and you don't want power in the hands of people like that.
I agree, he thoughtfully said.
His phone buzzed.
He got up and answered it. Not now, he said over the line. I know. He's just going to have to wait.
He returned to his chair and blew out a long breath, took his glasses off, and set them on the coffee table.
I think the best thing to do is send out a press release informing people that someone is impersonating you on the Internet, to do what we can to clear this up as much as possible, he said. We'll put an end to it, even if it requires a court order.
That would make me very happy, I said. He got up, and I did, too. Thank you, Sinclair. Thank God I have a shield like you.
We'll just hope the new secretary will be the same, he remarked, as if I knew what he was talking about.
What new secretary? I asked, as anxiety hummed again, this time more loudly. A strange expression passed over his face. Then he looked angry.
I've sent you several memos marked private and confidential. God damn it! Now this is going too far.
I've gotten nothing from you, I said. He pressed his lips together, his cheeks turning red. It was one thing to tamper with email. It was another to intercept the secretary's sealed, classified memorandums. Not even Rose opened anything like that.
Apparently the governor's crime commission's gotten stuck on the notion that we should transfer your office out of health and into public safety, he told me.
For God's sake, Sinclair, I exclaimed.
I know, I know.
He raised his hand to quiet me. This same ignorant proposal had come up shortly after I'd been hired. The police and forensic labs were under public safety, meaning, among other things, that if my office fell under public safety too, there would be no checks and balances anymore. The police department, in essence, would have a say-so in how I worked my cases. I've written position papers on this before, I told Dr. Wagner. Years ago, I fought it off by preaching to prosecutors and police chiefs. I even went to the defense attorney's bar. We can't let this happen. Dr. Wagner said nothing. Why now? I persisted. Why has this just come up now? The issue's been dormant for more than 10 years.
I think Representative Connors is pushing it because some of the higher-ups in law enforcement are pushing him, he said. Who the hell knows?
I did, and as I drove toward my office, I got energized. I thrived on unanswered questions, on excavating for what wasn't plain to see, on getting to the truth. What detractors like Chuck Ruffin and Diane Bray had not factored into their machinations was that they'd served to wake me up. A scenario was materializing in my mind. It was very simple. Someone wanted me shot out of the air so my office would be vulnerable to a takeover by public safety. I had heard rumblings that the current secretary, who I liked very much, was retiring. Wouldn't it be a coincidence if Bray just happened to take his place? When I reached my office, I smiled at Rose and bid her a cheery good morning. "Aren't we in a good mood today?" she said, enormously pleased. "It's your vegetable soup," I commented. "I have it to look forward to. Where's Chuck?" Just his name gave Rose a sour look. "Off delivering several brains to MCV," she replied. Now and then, when cases were neurologically suspicious and complicated, I would fix the brain in formalin and have it delivered to the neuropathology lab for special studies. "Let me know when he comes back," I told her. "We need to set up the Lumalite in the decomposed room." She placed her elbow on her desk, chin in her hand, and shook her head, eyes on me. "I hate to be the one who tells you this," she said. "Oh, God, now what? Just when I thought it might be a good day." The Institute's doing a mock crime scene, and it appears their Lumalite is in for repairs. Don't tell me. Well, all I know is someone called here, and Chuck took our Lumalite to them before he left for MCV. Then I'll just go get it back.
It's at an outdoor mock scene some 10 miles away.
Who gave Chuck the authority to lend it to anyone? I asked.
Just be glad it isn't stolen like half of everything else around here, she said.
I guess I'll just have to go upstairs and do the examination in Vander's lab, I said.
I walked into my office and sat down at my desk. I took my glasses off and massaged the bridge of my nose. I decided the time had come to set up a rendezvous between Bray and Chuck. I signed on to Ruffin's address and emailed a note to Bray.
Chief Bray, have some information you must know. Please meet me at Beverly Hills Shopping Center at 5:30. Park on back row near Buckhead's. We can talk in your car so nobody sees us. If you can't meet me, page me. Otherwise, I'll see you then. Chuck.
Then I sent him a text message page, purportedly from Bray, inviting him to the meeting.
Done, I said, yielding to a little self-congratulation just as the phone rang.
Yo, Marino said. Your personal investigator here. What you doing after work?
More work. Remember I said two can play this game? You're taking me to Buckhead's. We wouldn't want to miss a little rendezvous between two people near and dear to our hearts, would we? So I thought it might be nice if you took me out to dinner and we just happened to run into them, I said.
18. Marino met me in the parking lot as planned, and we got in his monster Dodge Ram quad cab pickup truck, because I didn't want to take the chance that Bray might recognize my Mercedes. It was dark and frigid out, but the rain had stopped. I was riding so high I could almost look transfer truckers in the eye. We followed Patterson Avenue toward Parham Road, a major thoroughfare in the city where people ate out and shopped and swarmed inside Regency Mall.
I gotta warn you, there ain't always a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, he said, throwing a cigarette butt out the window. One or both of them might decide not to show. Hell, they may be on to us, for all I know. But gotta give it a shot, right?
The Beverly Hills Shopping Center was a small strip of salons and a Ben Franklin Crafts and Frames store. The location was not at all where one might expect to find the city's finest chop house.
Don't see no sign of them, Marino said as we scanned. But we're a few minutes early.
He parked some distance away from the restaurant between two cars in front of Ben Franklin's and cut the engine. I opened my door.
Just where do you think you're going? He protested.
Inside the restaurant.
What if they roll up any minute and see you?
I have every right to be here.
What if she's in there at the bar? He worried. What are you going to say to her?
I'll offer to buy her a drink and then come out and get you.
Christ, Doc! Marino was getting increasingly adamant. I thought the whole point of this is to burn her.
Relax and let me do the talking.
Relax? I want to break the bitch's neck, he said.
We have to be smart. We walk out from behind a bunker and start firing, we might just get hit first.
You telling me you ain't going to tell it to her face you know what she's done? The email to Chuck and everything?
He was incredulous and furious and kept repeating himself.
Then what the hell are we doing here? He went on.
Marino, I tried to calm him down. You know better than this. You're an experienced detective, and that's what you have to be with her. She's formidable. I'm going to tell you right now you'll never muscle this woman into a corner. He was silent.
Keep a lookout from your truck while I check the inside of the restaurant. If you spot her before I do, send me a 10-4 on my pager and call the restaurant asking for me just in case I don't get the page for some reason, I said.
He angrily lit a cigarette as I opened my door.
It ain't fucking fair, he said. We know fucking well what she's doing. I still say we confront her and show her she ain't as smart as she thinks.
You, of all people, know about building cases, I reiterated. I was getting worried that he wouldn't be able to control himself.
We saw what she sent, Chuck.
Lower your voice, I said. We can't prove she sent that email any more than I can prove I didn't send email that's being attributed to me. I can't even prove I didn't write that dreadful column, for that matter.
Maybe I should just become a soldier of fortune.
He blasted smoke into the rearview mirror, scanning. Page or call me? I asked as I climbed out.
What if you don't get the message in time?
Then run her over with your truck, I impatiently replied, pushing the door shut. I looked around as I walked toward the restaurant and saw no sign of Bray. I had no idea what her personal car was, but suspected she wouldn't show up in it anyway. I pulled open the heavy wooden door of Buckhead's and was greeted by carefree voices and ice clinking in glasses as the bartender made drinks with a flourish. A mounted buck's head explained the restaurant's name. Lights were low, the paneling dark, and crates and racks of wine were stacked almost to the ceiling.
"Well, good evening," the hostess at the podium smiled in a surprised way. "We've missed you, but I certainly know from the news that you've been a little busy. What can I help you with?"
"A reservation in the name of Bray?" I inquired. "I'm not sure of the time." She scanned the big reservation book, running a pencil down names and times. Then she tried again. She looked embarrassed. After all, it was Friday, an impossible night to stroll into a good restaurant unannounced. "I'm afraid not," she quietly told me. "Maybe it's in my name?" I tried again. She tried again, too. "Gosh, I'm so sorry, Dr. Scarpetta. And we're full tonight because we have a group taking up the entire front room." It was 6:20 now. Tables were covered with red-checked cloth, small lamps burning on them, and the room was completely empty because civilized people rarely dined before 7. "I was going to have a drink with a friend," I continued my act. "I suppose we could eat early if you could fit us. Maybe around 6?
"That's no problem at all," she said, brightening up.
"Then put me down," I replied, as my worries intensified. What if Bray realized Chuck's car wasn't in the lot and became suspicious?
"Then 6 it is."
I was acutely aware of the pager on my belt and listening for a phone to ring.
"Perfect," I said to the hostess.
This scenario curdled my sensibilities. It was my nature, my training, and my professional practice to always tell the truth, in no way to slip into the behavior of the wily, low-life trial lawyer I could have been, had I given myself up to manipulation, evasion, and the gray areas of the law. The hostess penciled my name in the book as my pager vibrated like a big insect. I read the 10-4 on the display and hurried back through the bar. I had no choice but to open the front door because the windows were opaque and I could not see through them. I spotted the dark Crown Victoria. Marino didn't do anything right away.